The MMQB podcast is brought to you by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your tickets, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB for $20 off your first tickets. We're also sponsored by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter the promo code THEMMQB at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. Are you going to get up and watch this? This is games at 9:30 Eastern Time, 6:30 Pacific. Are you going to watch this game?
There's literally no chance I see this game live.
Literally no chance.
I mean, it's just, it's almost impossible. I guess if there was some incentive, like somebody was going to pay me.
Well, they do pay. You're the one always reminding me, hey, quit complaining. We get paid to watch football.
Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I'm Robert Klimko. The man you just heard from is Andy Benoit. We are writers for the MMQB. As always, we will be previewing the NFL action this weekend. Now it's week four, am I right?
It's week four. I love how quickly the season moves along. We've already got bye weeks too, which makes our workload nice and, I guess, not nice and light yet, but it's getting lighter for the mid-season stretch.
Yeah, and I'm sure those teams that have the byes resent them having them so early in the season when you don't really need them yet. I think it's the Patriots, and who else has one?
And Tennessee.
Yeah, so we won't be talking about those teams, but we will be talking about the rest of the week four action. And by the way, our Twitter follower, Bill Strzewski? He says
I left it up to you. That's why you're doing the intro today.
We started the MMQB podcast drinking game last week, and he notes at Bill Strzewski that if listeners also drink when Andy says concepts, the word concepts, they're good for at least a half dozen sips a week. So crack open your beers because we're going to jump right in it. Packers at 49ers. The Packers are 3-0. The 49ers are 1-2. Aaron Rodgers throws five touchdowns en route to a 38-28 victory over the Chiefs, and yet Pro Football Focus, your favorite football grading website, says he earns a negative grade. I know you don't love talking about the grading websites, but I just want your thoughts on that performance against the Chiefs, which conventionally, if you looked at it as a fan, you might say, I don't know who's doing it better than that guy, Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, Rodgers will always look worse on a grading scale. I don't know how their grading scale works. I don't know the details of it, but he is not a conventional QB, and he does leave throws on the field. He does play out of structure at times, and it's absolutely no problem whatsoever, obviously. I mean, sometimes let's just not overthink this stuff. Five touchdowns is indicative of a certain level of performance. You know what occurs to me, Klimko? I don't know. This might be in the history of the NFL the greatest discrepancy in quarterbacks as far as the performance they're coming off of from the previous week. I don't know if we've ever seen a five-touchdown guy go up against a four-interception guy the next week, but not only were Kaepernick's four interceptions costly, they were each individually his fault, and in their own unique way, they were horrendous quarterbacking plays. That was probably the worst game of his career. And now they host Aaron Rodgers in the Packers, so he's going to have to probably put up 35 points this week.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'd have to go back for recent history and look at some of those disastrous Matt Schaub performances in Houston to see if he ever played another guy coming off of a hot game.
How is it that you work a Titans quarterback slam into this segment here already?
Texans.
Texans quarterback slam.
Maybe people should drink every time I go in on the Texans.
Yeah, you could control that. I mean, that would be – maybe take a shot. Just one good – because that would be one good shot a show. But no, I know what you're saying. Yeah, Matt Schaub, Texans, they stink. You don't like them. The Niners have a problem at quarterback right now. And I don't know if you can coach this stuff out of a guy. With Kaepernick, there were issues with pocket movement. There was no subtlety whatsoever in his pocket movement. Off-balance throws without defining the coverage, throws late in the down, throws out of timing. It's hard to go – I mean, you can't emphasize enough the extremity of how bad these interceptions looked for him last week. And yeah. it's one game, yes, and I thought he did look very good in week one, but it's also a microcosm of a lot of the negative parts of his career. Now they all got magnified in one week.
Yeah, and I think they're going up against probably the worst opponent they could face at the moment with a defensive line that doesn't necessarily need to blitz right now to create pressure. I was very impressed over the last couple of weeks with the play of both Mike Daniels and B.J. Raji. Let's not spend too much time on this game as we think we know how it's going to go. Let's move on to Rams at Cardinals. The Rams are 1-2. They fail to come back and beat the Steelers, lose 12-6. The Cardinals are 3-0. They absolutely trounced the 49ers 47-7 for reasons that we just discussed. The Rams on offense have accumulated the fewest yards in the NFL with 823 and also the fewest first downs. Is there a team in the NFL with as much a disparity between the success of the defense and the failure of the offense?
Oh, that's a good question. Off the top of my head, I would say no, there's not, at least. And I would even factor into the disparity, the level of talent and what you can do with the defense and the offense. With that defense, there's every concept is on the table. you can play straight up zone coverage. You can do man off coverage, man concepts. You can disguise. It's the fastest defense in the NFL. And then on the flip side, the offense is very, very controlled. The Rams know what they are, and they know that they're going to have to win games some weeks 13-10. And it's got to be disheartening to them that they were in a game 12-6 against the best team, best offense in the NFL, and they came out on the short end of that stick. Because if the Rams don't win those kind of games, they're not going to do much better than 6-10 or 7-9. By their nature, they're going to be in a lot of close contests because they're nothing more than a power running team, and anything they do in the passing game, it has to be a function of play design, like a first down play action shot that exploits a specific zone coverage. They don't have guys on the perimeter, and they really don't have the quarterback to just line up and beat you consistently in obvious passing situations.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how the Cardinals stack up on offense against this Rams defense. You have a team that's probably playing top five defense in the NFL going up against an under-the-radar quarterback in Carson Palmer, who leads the league right now with 9 passing touchdowns. Can that be right?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about Palmer a lot this week, and I got done watching the Cardinals film earlier today. I think we need to start considering him back in the discussion where not as the best QB in the league, which is where he was early in his Bengals career. At least he was on the fringes of that discussion when it was the Brady Manning era.
It was a perennial perennial Pro Bowler.
Yeah. And I think he's at that level again right now. You could say that there is no quarterback who better fits his offense than Carson Palmer fits Bruce Arians' system. And the Niners game was as impressive on his end as it was unimpressive on Kaepernick's end. He fit the ball through tight zone windows, throws with anticipation. He's oblivious to pressure. And there's nothing more to say about the guy other than that he plays in a really well-designed scheme, and he has a perfect mastery of the scheme's concepts. Darn it, we can't do this concept. It's going to make me hiccup every single time.
It's bothering you, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, we're 2 games in. I'm 2 concepts in.
Well, let's go to the third. Giants at Bills. The Giants are 1-2. They defeat Washington 32-21. The Bills are 2-1. They just shut down the Dolphins 41-14. I was surprised to see that much of a margin of victory there. How has Greg Roman's, and I know you like Greg Roman, especially as a coach of the running game, how do you feel like his scheme, what he's brought to Rex Ryan's team here in the first 3 weeks of the season has helped this offense?
Well, I am much, much more encouraged after seeing the entirety of that game against Miami, because I felt against New England 2 weeks ago, I thought Roman asked a little too much of Tyrod Taylor. There were a lot of isolation routes in Buffalo's passing game, which require a quarterback to progression read across the entire field in a lot of situations. And that's just not the kind of player Taylor is at this point. Most guys with his lack of experience are not that kind of player. Against Miami, it was like watching a whole different offense, because the approach was way different. Everything early in the game was a defined read for Taylor. And you get to define reads off of things like screen passes, play action rollouts, and they made Charles Clay a big weapon in that regard, which is what exactly what they brought him in for. It's good to see him getting worked into the offense. And they also used Taylor's legs more as part of the design of things. So it's, and it helped that he was going up against Bryce McCain, who's a cornerback not playing particularly well right now. But to answer the question and speak on topic, this, I'll be real interested to see how this game goes, if they can build on that. Because I think Roman, in his heart of hearts, I think he wants a progression read QB. He's a clever downfield passing game designer as much as he is a run game guy. And it might be tempting for him to do that, but he can't play that way with this guy. He needs to have defined reads, misdirection, and win through almost ball control.
And I think that's fine in terms of his personal goals. I mean, the guy wants to be a head coach. How better to demonstrate that than to win, you know, 9 or 10 games with Tyrod Taylor running your offense?
No question. If the Bills get to 10 wins this season, and they're capable of that, Greg Roman catapults to the top 5 in the head coaching searches across the league.
Yeah, completely agree there. Let's go to Eagles at Washington. The Eagles are 1-2. Washington 1-2. The Eagles halt the Jets comeback 24-17 last week. The Giants once again beat Washington 32-21. How were the Eagles able to find success on the ground in a game that they really had to win to stay relevant? Although, I guess you could start 0-3 and make the playoffs out of the NFC East, but sitting much prettier at 1-2, how did the Eagles find success on the ground with Ryan Matthews, guy we forget about, I think was a first-round pick of the Chargers a few years ago, yes?
Yeah, he was, and he was also a guy they signed in free agency for decent money. I mean, yeah, it would have been the best contract for a running back had he signed the year before.
Sure.
So it's, yeah, Ryan Matthews is not just some guy you put on the bench and hope he gets 400 yards for you over the course of a season. In fact, you could say, and I watched every snap of this game, and it's easy to say this right now because DeMarco Murray has not been good and he hasn't gotten a lot of help, but he's really not been good the first 2 weeks. You could say Matthews is a better fit stylistically for this offense. He can get to the perimeter without having to stop his feet to change directions, and that's a big deal in this offense. He's a little more decisive. There's a natural fluidity to him. He's not as good as Murray is on contact late in the down or finishing runs, but early in the runs, getting outside, which is what he was able to do against the Jets, and a few times he capitalized on mistakes, but overall he was able to scrap some yards on the perimeter against New York. That's an element of this offense, I think, that's an important one, and one that Murray doesn't necessarily offer the way Matthews does.
And I think you wrote essentially that about Murray in the offseason, and really that he left a lot of yards on the field in Dallas. And your boy Jimmy Kimski with one of the Philly local outlets jumped all over you. Have you heard from him since DeMarco Murray's struggles have began?
I haven't. I don't really pay close attention to that. And I know – so what – I don't know if anyone saw – well, I'm sure people saw this because I got bad tweets back about it. But I had not met Jimmy Kimski before. Someone texted me and showed me I guess he went through and dissected and kind of tried to tear apart my article on Murray. And I was texting back. It was like my direct message was going to my text. I don't know how that's set up, but that's the way my phone is. And one of them, I texted back to the guy, and I just said, who's Jimmy Kimski? I'd never heard of him.
There's no way. There's no way your Twitter is connected to your text.
My Twitter direct messages come to my phone in the form of a text message.
Okay. All right.
But here's what I learned the hard way, Robert. Here's what I learned. If I text it back, sometimes it isn't treated as a direct message. My phone treats it as a regular tweet,
yeah,
which is exactly what happened here. So Jimmy Kimski wrote an article going after what I wrote, which, you know, that's fine. He did analysis on his end, and it was a headbutting thing. But all I tweeted out was, who is Jimmy Kimski? And that's the only thing I accidentally tweeted. It's the only thing I tweeted for the entire day.
Which was kind of appropriate.
Well, I mean, I don't know. But now I remember the name, and I no longer tweet, you know, through. I don't use my phone for anything on Twitter ever anymore. It's all old, I guess, kind of old fashioned. It's on the computer.
I've been holding back the urge to throw this back in Jimmy's face, but I feel kind of weird about it because I think it's a kind of a childish thing.
Well, yeah, maybe, but you know, if you go and and gloat when a guy doesn't play well after 2 weeks. I mean, you're going to leave yourself open to all kinds of criticism because we all make so many proclamations. None of them are all going to come true. You're going to be right and wrong a certain percent of the time. And you don't want to duck up to either side of that aisle, to the right side or the wrong side, because it's just a waste of energy, I've learned. Yeah. Here's the thing, though, about to bring it back to DeMarco Murray. And he's been leaving yards on the field in Philadelphia. That's one. And not just in the running game, but even in some of the passes he's caught. He's just not reading the field with a clarity right now. Same was true of his quarterback, by the way. But two is I have heard from numerous coaches that the Cowboys felt he left yards on the field last season and that coaches around the league watching the film felt the same thing. It's just because a guy had 1,850 yards, I know this sounds crazy, and it was still a good season by Murray, but someone told me, one of the coaches said there were 2,500 yards to be had in that offense in Dallas last year. I was thinking Murray would be a good fit for Philadelphia because he is more of a one, you know, a hit it and go runner, and they didn't like LeSean McCoy's dancing, I guess. But Murray has not been hitting it and going so far. And I think Matthews, so far, he's been the more decisive runner. Also, the Eagles made great use of wheel routes and the passing game. And a wheel route, in their case, they brought a running back out of the backfield and ran essentially down the sideline. And you get matched against the linebacker and man coverage when you do that. Even if it's zone, a lot of times the linebacker has to treat it as man coverage. That's a great way to keep Bradford comfortable while he is clearly struggling to pick up, I don't know, the rhythm, the flow, the timing of the offense. He's not reading defenses clearly. And if they need to keep Bradford above water, then Darren Sproles and Matthews become even more important in the passing game. And Matthews has more to offer in the passing game.
Yeah, and Darren Sproles, though, one of the rare guys who can actually run that wheel and execute it in time for the quarterback to get it out of his hands. Oakland Raiders at Chicago Bears. The Raiders are 2-1. The Bears 0-3. I tweeted this week that I believe the Raiders have finally found their core, that being Khalil Mack, quarterback, Derek Carr, younger brother of David, and wide receiver Amari Cooper. I had an interesting discussion with a couple of followers, and we are going to get to some the MMQB podcast hashtag tweets here, but I asserted that those were the three most important positions, that if you were going to build a franchise, all things being equal, that those are the positions that you would draft. Obviously, a guy like Gronkowski is an outlier. Maybe you would draft him before a wide receiver. But for the most part, would you agree that if you were starting a franchise, you would go quarterback, pass rusher, wide receiver, or left tackle, cornerback in that mix for you?
Cornerback is. Left tackle's nowhere near that mix for me. And yeah. I think the Raiders are a good example. They have a good one, not a great one, but a good one in Donald Penn. And he has more than sufficed for what you need out of a left tackle. He's been very stellar for them in pass protection. All you need with a left tackle is a guy who can break even. You don't need Tyron Smith. It helps to have that. Certainly it helps your running game especially. But in pass protection, the outcome of a average pass block renders the same outcome as a great pass block, which is your quarterback's clean enough to throw the ball.
Well, I think it's a little bit more significant if you have a Peyton Manning and you're trying to minimize the overall damage that he takes over the course of a year.
Yeah, it could be, and obviously it varies and it depends on who your quarterback is, but let's put it on Derek Carr for a second, and there are other guys in the league that are similar to him in terms of the approach. He's at his best in a spread offense where the ball's out in 3 seconds. He's also very good on the move. Both of those things negate the significance of a left tackle for you, and there are other quarterbacks who have played that way. Look, left tackles to me are fine, but for the amount of money they cost right now, and I wrote this actually in the magazine a few weeks ago for SI, they don't begin to justify the amount of money they cost right now. They're the second highest paid position in the league. I agree with you, Robert. I would put receiver ahead of them. I'd put certainly obviously quarterback. I'd put cornerback. I'd put pass rusher above them. I might even put, if I had a hybrid safety or someone I could build kind of a scheme around, not a Polamalu, but a guy of that ilk, an Eric Weddle type, I'd probably put that ahead of a left tackle.
Sure. Back to this game, for the Bears, Alshon Jeffrey returns from a 2-game absence. His hamstring injury has slowed him down this season. The Raiders, in a rare occurrence in the last decade, are favored on the road. Is this a game that you see getting tight, or do you see the Raiders running away with this? And I know we're not picking games, but how do you feel the Bears match up against the Raiders offense?
Well, the Bears right now, and I don't mean this facetiously or anything, but they don't match up well to anybody right now. I mean, they have holes on defense. The personnel does not fit the scheme. They've got some guys that are playing better than I thought. Pernell McPhee's one that I didn't expect. The defense has been much better than I expect, but it's still not one that you can build around. And the problem is they need to build around it because the offense has as many question marks. And I get the sense that, and maybe it's because they were missing Cutler last week, but I get the sense Adam Gase is going to be really reaching for stuff to try to find the right identity with this offense. My guess is next year, this time next year, more than 50% of the Bears roster will have been turned over.
Yeah, there was an interesting somebody did a breakdown of all the three drafts under former GM Phil Emery, and about 40% of the guys that he picked are no longer on the roster after 3 years. Most recently, they released safety Brock Vereen out of Minnesota, who actually wrote wrote a nice piece for the MMQB, but apparently hasn't been doing too well on the field. Vikings at Broncos. The Vikings are 2-1. The Broncos are 3-0. Adrian Peterson back in action for the Vikings. They run over the Chargers 31-14. The Broncos defense again leads in a winning effort 24-12 over the Lions, although Peyton did flash some big play ability. Here's what I wanted to know about. All of Adrian Peterson's carries come with him lined up 7 yards behind Teddy Bridgewater. He goes 20 carries, 126 yards, and 2 touchdowns versus the Vikings. Is this one of the last guys that we see in this traditional running back role who's not standing next to a quarterback before he takes a handoff?
Yeah, because they're putting Bridgewater under center a little bit for their running game. And the last 2 weeks, Minnesota has come out with inside zone runs. And inside zone, it's not what you think with outside zone, like the Alex Gibbs, Houston Texans, old Denver Broncos stuff. Inside zone's downhill, smash mouth, power running. You get two double teams inside, and those double teamers work up to the linebackers, and you ram the ball down the opponent's throat. That's the goal. And they have been very committed to that approach with Peterson after really not using him at all in week one. And Norv Turner's making it clear what way he wants to play. They're going to be a power offense with some deeper drop stuff in the passing game to set up play action. It's a very old school approach. You don't see this kind of vertical offense in the NFL anymore, and vertical being also the element of just pure downhill running. So I think that's the formula for him, and that's what you have to stop. I don't know how I interpret this, but if Minnesota's running game was not great last week, Peterson put up yards because he made a few individual plays, namely twice he beat safety Jimmy Wilson one-on-one. So you could say the Vikings, even now, although they're being productive on the ground, really haven't gotten going. And I think it's inevitable at some point, being in the system they're in and with the running back they have, that they are going to get going at some point. So we could just be scratching the surface with Peterson right now.
Well, if you're in the Denver area this weekend and you want to go to that game, I might suggest that you use the SeatGeek app. If you use your promo code MMQB, you get $20 off your first ticket purchase. The SeatGeek app takes less than a minute to download, and it's free on iPhone and Android smartphones. SeatGeek does a ton of things that other ticketing sites don't. They aggregate from big ticket sites. Just like when you search for flights and hotels online, SeatGeek pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers to create a one-stop shop for sports and concert tickets. When you shop on SeatGeek, you're seeing virtually every ticket option available for that game, all on one page. No need to go anywhere else. SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and safe. On SeatGeek, you can store your credit card, and once you find a ticket you want to buy, you can complete the purchase with just 2 quick taps. There's no faster way to buy tickets. To redeem your promo code and save $20 on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app today. Enter promo code MMQB in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. If you want to go see the NFL, college football, or the best concerts, use SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB to save $20.
From at Peter Kinberg, it wants to know, has the offensive line improved or are they playing worse defenses? And it's hard to tell because we're only 3 games in. So what's the worst? I mean, worst defense from 1 week to the next is really what we're talking about. But the offensive line has improved. More than that, Manning, I think, is taking more command of things. And their issues in the first few games, they were not picking up blitz concepts schematically or in their execution. And when you put the game in Manning's hands, that's a great way to take care of those other issues. And so the more the game goes in Manning's hands, the less of an issue the offensive line will be. They still might have weaknesses and it might compromise them at times. But from a tactical standpoint, they're not going to keep blowing protections the way they did in weeks one and two.
John Tyler at JCM Tyler asks, does lack of preseason work by veterans show up as ugly play in the first couple of games? I think that's true for certain positions. I think it's certainly true for young quarterbacks who don't have a lot of rhythm or experience in whatever offense they're in. I think it's the case for a lot of offensive lines. To me, as I watch these games, those are the two position groups that really suffer with the lack of offseason practice time and really the lack of, more of a developmental league like baseball has or basketball has with the D-League. And I think that the NFL is recognizing that, and they're going to make a big push here to try to get a minor league. Would you agree that it shows in the offensive line more than most positions?
It could, and that's, I haven't thought about it a whole lot in terms of position breakdown. I agree with you about quarterbacks, and if the NFL is ever to have a minor league, and it's a separate discussion, I realize, but it will have to be a consequence of the quarterback position being negated or compromised by a lack of offseason work. You know, the NFL is not going to start a minor league because offensive linemen aren't playing as well. But if quarterbacks, if the perception is quarterbacks aren't getting the training, maybe that comes to fruition, a developmental league. With lines, anymore, so much of an offensive line's performance is reactionary to pressure looks and concepts. And I don't know the answer to that. I haven't played the game, so I don't know if that's something that's a product of being on the field or not. You can theoretically, let's say you're looking at double A-gap blitz where they're bringing six potential pass rushers, you can spend days in a classroom coming up with solutions to that and be prepared. But maybe it's different once you get out on the field and actually have to physically react to it, and you're also seeing the stuff not on a blackboard but down at eye level with you. So maybe that is something. I would be real curious to ask an offensive line coach what they thought, because I'm sure they'd have a good answer.
Yeah. Let's jump back into these games here. Kansas City Chiefs at Cincinnati Bengals. The Chiefs are 1-2. The Bengals are 3-0. The Bengals are undefeated after a 28-24 win over the Ravens in a game I attended. Andy Dalton passed for a career-high 383 yards against Baltimore. We had a Twitter follower ask the question, and this was Paul Hirons at Son of Ray, who asks, is Andy Dalton doing anything differently technique-wise, or is this another one of his hot streaks? It's very hard to say. I didn't see anything technique-wise that jumped out to me, but it's hard to say because throughout the entire second half of that game, it was the A.J. Green show. They were just finding ways that A.J. Green could beat Jimmy Smith and Will Hill and exploit what is probably the weakest part of the Baltimore defense. So I didn't see it as anything more complicated than A.J. being better than the guy that was lined up across from him. But maybe you saw it differently.
Yeah, I haven't seen that game. I'm going to do the film on later in the week on that one. I've seen Cincinnati's other two games on film. Dalton has looked better to me. Whether it's a hot streak or not, you know, I can't speak to that because I don't know what the future holds for him. But so far, how he's playing, he's looked sharp. He's mentally sharp. That's never been a problem with him. It's the unclear decisions that he'll sometimes make, the brain farts, if you will, after the snap that makes his game difficult. That and inconsistent mechanics, which will lead to inaccuracies in his throws, mainly with his footwork. But those issues have not shown themselves through the first three games this season. They've got a lot of guys around them, too, and that helps to have the running backs and the receivers around you. Everyone's healthy in Cincy. Remember, Cincy was not healthy last year.
Right. They've got so much in terms of firepower. I mean, Tyler Eifert, although he didn't do really anything in this game, he catches a touchdown that I thought should have been a touchdown that gets called off because he was falling to the ground, crossed the goal line, and then the ball popped out once his hand hit the ground. I think he's been especially effective in their first two wins. You have Jeremy Hill and Giovanni Bernard, two very different running backs who both can pass block. And one, Gio Bernard, is shifty and more of an outside runner and can catch the ball out of the backfield. And Jeremy Hill, more of a bruiser. I think that they probably have a top five skill position group in the NFL. And one of the reasons that you haven't seen Andy Dalton make some of the big mistakes that he's made in the past is, you take this Ravens game, for instance, the Ravens haven't been able to produce any meaningful pressure on quarterbacks yet. They've been experimenting with, you know, defensive back blitzes, inside linebacker pressure, but really just from that front four or five guys that are rushing, they haven't gotten much. And I think that's a function of Terrell Suggs being out. But we're going to talk a little bit about the Ravens later. In this matchup here, the Chiefs visit Cincinnati, having allowed the fifth most passing yards in the NFL, 861 yards. Do you see anything going differently for A.J. Green in this game versus the Ravens game, in which he catches 227 yards and two of Dalton's three touchdowns?
Well, the Chiefs get Sean Smith back, and not a moment too soon. And what a great illustration of why your off-field behavior does matter, and you can really hurt your team and you get in trouble, because Sean Smith got himself suspended three games, and Kansas City's two losses, you could probably, maybe not the Green Bay one, but I think certainly the Denver one, you can pin on ineptitude at the cornerback position. Jamel Fleming had a tough go of it. Phillip Gaines has since gotten hurt. He was not in there in the second half of last week's game. And to tell you how down they were on Fleming after the Denver game, instead of putting him in the slot, or I thought it was weird, instead of moving Ron Parker to the slot, they came in with Tyvon Branch at safety and played slot receiver against Randall Cobb. Anytime you get that matchup and it's a little bit by choice, that tells you that the coaching staff has absolutely no faith in the cornerbacks. That's a problem when you play as much man coverage as Kansas City plays. So Sean Smith comes back. I'll be real interested to see if he follows A.J. Green around, or if they just let Marcus Peters play left cornerback like he's been playing and keep Smith on the right side, which is what I think they'll do. But Smith does have the long arms. He's physically built to match up to Green really well, much similar to Ike Taylor, who was probably Green's toughest nemesis for a lot of years there. So maybe they do shadow around. Whatever it is, they need that guy on the field, and they need everyone to stay healthy, because if after those two, they're still weak in the secondary.
We want to move on to Jets at Dolphins. We want to get to all 14 games, is it, this week?
15 games, which 15 teams on games. The bye. Are you going to get up and watch this? This is games at 9:30 Eastern time. That's 7:30 for me, 6:30 Pacific. Are you going to watch this game?
There's literally no chance I see this game live.
Literally no chance.
I mean, it's just, it's almost impossible. I guess if there was some incentive, like somebody was going to pay me.
Well, they do pay. You're the one always reminding me, hey, quit complaining. We get paid to watch football.
But I don't get paid to watch every game.
I remember last year I watched the Lions Falcons game. The Sundays can kind of feel like long days after a while. I like them. Don't get me wrong. I really like them. But I stay up late and write and do stuff after the games. But I did watch the Falcons Lions, and it was such a good ending. I felt so rewarded for doing it. I might just watch this one on DVR starting it a few hours later on the strength of last year's exciting finish still.
If they were to send two contenders over there, like Packers, Packers Broncos, yeah, I would get up at 9:30 in the morning. But to watch, the two teams that are going to finish third and fourth in the AFC East play in London at 9:30 in the morning.
I don't know about third and fourth. That's a little pessimistic.
You don't think the Bills will beat out both these guys?
No, I think the Jets are the second best team in the AFC East.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's quickly talk about this game. Is the 2015 Dolphins defense in your mind any better with Sue than they were in general in 2014?
They haven't been so far. They've been a very disappointing group, and it's not because of Ndamukong Suh, but this is what I wrote about in their preview. The problem is they were already good along the defensive line, so Suh maybe took them from good to great, potentially. Now, Cameron Wake hasn't been the same guy this year. Other guys, even Olivier Vernon's had kind of a quiet season, so they're not even close to great right now, but theoretically, they're built along the defensive front to be not just good but great there. The problem is the amount of guaranteed money, and in 2016, the amount of cap space they're going to have dedicated to that idea of being great instead of just good along the front. So, on the back end, the question with Miami has been about their cornerbacking core, and that's been clearly the problem this season. I mentioned McCain earlier. He's the problem at one cornerback spot. Even Brent Grimes, who's an excellent player, combined with McCain, they don't have a lot of size there. So if anyone's able to challenge those cornerbacks, they have a great chance of winning. which is why Sue has to be even great beyond great, because you have to offset the other weaknesses that his presence has entailed.
So I guess if you like defense, get up at 9:30 a.m. Sunday, because the Jets' defense has allowed the fewest points in all of football this season, and the Dolphins are looking better than 2014, though maybe not necessarily due to Ndamukong and Sue.
Going to tell you about FanDuel. By now, even our soon-to-be-discovered life forms on Mars have probably heard of FanDuel. This site is all over, everywhere. FanDuel.com is the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They're going to pay up to $75 million a week this season, even over $75 million in some weeks. We all love fantasy football. The advantage with FanDuel is you get a new team each week. You're not stuck with the same team you drafted at the beginning of the season and saw all your guys get injured and are no longer a part of. For entry fees that start at just $1, there's a league for everyone. And over 1 million players have won money playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. Now it's your turn. So go to FanDuel.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use the code THEMMQB, that's THEMMQB, and sign up now. There's a special offer for new users. Every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it, which is up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. The offer is only good for the first 50 people that use the code THEMMQB. FanDuel.com.
Well, we've hit the home stretch in the MMQB podcast, previewing week 4. Let's jump back into the games. Jaguars at Colts, both teams 1-2. The Patriots absolutely shellacked the Jaguars, 51-17. The Colts make a late run and prevent an 0-3 start, beating the Titans and the surprising young Marcus Mariota, 35-33. The Pats scored on all 9 possessions against the Jags last Sunday. Do you buy into the idea that there are let down games after you play a cupcake opponent like that?
Not really. I'm sure that's happened before, but there's no way to forecast or prove it. So, you know, I mean, that's now you get into like trying to predict psychology, and that just doesn't work.
Yeah. In the first 3 quarters, Sunday versus Tennessee for the Colts, Andrew Luck goes 7-for-17 for 116 yards and 2 interceptions. In the fourth quarter, he goes 11-for-13, 144 yards, 2 touchdowns. That's a passer rating of 152.4. Did you get a chance to watch this game?
I haven't yet. I will watch it at the end of the week. With Jacksonville having the bye, New England had the bye, so I wasn't going to watch a Patriots film until at the end of the week.
I'm watching these Colts games, and I can't tell if Andrew Luck is making poor decisions. These guys aren't getting open. Is it a function of the pass protection not being there? I mean, they just look overall like a mediocre offense from a team that everybody expected to, you know, contend for a Super Bowl this year.
Yeah, it's been surprising. They are a 5-7 step timing offense, meaning they take deep drops in the passing game. And the reason for that is because they have all that speed at wide receiver. T.Y. Hilton, Moncrief, they drafted Dorsett. They're built to stretch the field. The problem is that takes time. And if you don't have very good pass protection, Andrew Luck's a genius in certain scenarios under pressure, but he can't be that on every single snap when he's under pressure. And he has had some ill decisions with guys bearing down on him. There's been situations where he hasn't had a chance flat out to compete. And so they need to get the pass protection woes solved one way or the other. And the way to solve it might be to amend their approach to offense, which coordinator Pep Hamilton suggested a few days ago, maybe a few weeks ago at this point, that he might need to do that. That maybe the problem is some of the play calling. It's on him. Whatever it is, the ball's got to start getting out quicker, because the offense in Indianapolis can't function with the style they want to play based on the offensive line they have. Yeah.
Moving on to Panthers at Bucks. The Panthers are 3-0 after beating the Saints 27-22. The Bucks are 1-2. Their offense comes to a screeching halt against the Texans. They lose 19-9. We wondered at the beginning of the season how the Panthers would compensate for what was perceived as a very poor offensive line, and we have our answer. 98 rushing attempts, second in the league. and 396 yards for 4 yards per carry. And they're not getting very much out of Jonathan Stewart, who just has a career low 3.5 yards per carry. What are they doing that's so special in the running game that's allowing them to compete?
Well, it's the Cam Newton factor, and not just him getting yards on his own running, although he's been doing that, but the way defenses must account for him. He is a threat in the running game, almost like in ways that we haven't seen from other QBs, because he'll be physical. He can be physical. He doesn't need to be in space to run the ball. So his read options have more dimension to him. They've done a great job, Mike Shula, the offensive coordinator there, of building additional options into the read option. They've got a lot of run plays that really are two different plays operating at once, and where the ball goes depends on which play it turns out to be. That's a much more complex read option game than what we see from other teams around the NFL. So it's a college style offense, and that sounds disparaging, but when you break it down, it could also be complementary because of how impressive the running game is put together. And it all works because the guy that starts with the ball, Cam Newton, is as good a running threat as anybody else on that team.
The Carolina Panthers trade for Jared Allen. In your mind, what does he bring to this defense that they were lacking before?
Not a lot, because Charles Johnson went down with an ugly-looking, I think it was a hamstring injury, and he's out 2 months at least. So Allen's getting plugged in there. I would be surprised if he has a huge impact. You know, he wasn't fitting in Chicago's scheme. He'd never been a 3-4 outside linebacker. And so they were going to move him one way or the other, whether it was this season or next season. He was also not super productive a year ago as a 4-3 defensive end. There are people around the league who think Jared Allen's had a tremendous career and is now at the end of his rope. I have learned over the years, I thought that several years ago, and I was wrong. And he's kind of one of those guys that I just have decided I'm not going to predict till I'll ever get old. I'd rather be wrong one more time than risk being wrong 5 more times with him, which I have been so far. So maybe he can bring something because he's been a pure edge rusher before. You know, there's a reason he got acquired for a 6th round pick, though, too.
Yeah. Moving on to Browns at Chargers. The Browns are 1-2, as are the Chargers. The Browns lose to the Raiders 27-20. The Chargers' run defense continues to struggle in a 31-14 loss to the Vikings. Two teams that have fielded porous run defenses in the last 3 weeks. The Chargers have allowed over 160 total yards rushing in back-to-back games. Cleveland has allowed the most rushing yards this season, 475. Who do you see having the edge in the matchup on the ground?
I like San Diego has more talent because I like Melvin Gordon a lot. And they run him out of 3 receiver sets. So will they run him against a smaller Browns defense? The Browns get more athletic when you spread out. I'm surprised when they spread out, that is, because they have pretty good DBs. But I'm surprised that they're struggling in the run game for a second straight year. Danny Shelton looked very good to me in week 1. I haven't been able to watch him, you know, every single – I guess I've seen every snap. You don't sit and just watch one guy. So he hasn't jumped out as much since then. But I thought they've got something there. And maybe it's the inconsistencies that come with being a rookie. But if their run defense is going to be fixed, it's going to start with Shelton.
Texans at Falcons. The Texans are 1-2. The Falcons 3-0. Devonta Freeman, speaking of running games, 30 carries for 141 yards and 3 touchdowns last week in the big win over the Dallas Cowboys. He also has 5 catches for 52 yards. I think a lot of people were wondering who would end up being the lead guy in that backfield. Tevin Coleman was in the discussion. We know now. How do you see him matching up against the Houston Texans defense?
Well, Coleman's been hurt, and when he comes back into the lineup, he won the job. And when he comes back, I'd be surprised if Freeman doesn't take at least a sizable portion of his carries. He might not take all of them or even half of them, but Freeman needs to be on the field more. He's just quicker and faster than Coleman, and the difference in their powers not significant. You can do more things for Freeman. He was very, very good against Dallas, very explosive. And if he can contribute in the passing game as well, that gives them more dimension on offense. They're a team that wants to play with a fullback on the field. So someone else has to be a pass catcher. It can't just be Jones and White because they don't have a lot at the tight end position either. So Freeman can give them that dimension too.
Yeah. going forward to Cowboys at Saints, the Cowboys 2-1, the Saints 0-3. The Cowboys defense fails to stop Freeman, previously mentioned. The Saints fall to the Panthers 27-22. The Saints, I think you could say at this point, with Drew Brees, is he hurt, is he not hurt, when is he coming back, are basically out of the playoff conversation. The Dallas Cowboys are not, though they are waiting for their quarterback, Tony Romo, and Brandon Whedon looks to be starting for at least the next several games. Prior to facing the Falcons, Dallas's defense was ranked first against the run. How did the Falcons tear them up?
Well, Freeman had a very good day. Dallas did a lot in week two with defensive line slanting, and that really compromised. When you can slant your D lineman and go from one gap to the next and do twists and stunts and just be very active there, that can compromise zone blocking principles, and that was the problem that Philly had against Dallas. I watched the film against Atlanta, and I didn't see as much of that. And I don't know why that is. If it was an execution or if they have a conscious decision, whatever it was, but it was not as active of a defensive line last week. And then the other factor is there were scenarios. Dallas did a lot to double team Julio Jones, and there were certain scenarios where they played two safeties back deep, and I'm sure that contributed to Atlanta's approach a little bit. They weren't quite as proactive in coverage, against the run because of what they had to do in coverage. That will not be a problem against the Saints. If they can get an answer for Brandon Cooks, then they can play man-to-man or one-on-one scenarios across the board against the rest of that offense.
We'll go ahead to our final game here on the Week 4 podcast. Lions 0-3 at Seattle 1-2. Two teams that have been disappointments in different ways, though you figure Seattle will soon bounce back from an 0-2 start and take control or at least compete with the Cardinals in the NFC West. Don't really have the same hope for the Lions at this point. They fall to the Broncos 24-12. I watched this game, and to me, they looked poorly coached, especially in the run game. And I hate to say that about Joe Lombardi, who I think is a rising star in the league as an offensive coordinator. But their offense, despite all the weapons that they have, has been completely unimpressive to me.
They're having a tough go of it. They're trying. It starts with the ground game, and in their case, a total lack thereof. And Lombardi, yes, he has Calvin Johnson and Matthew Stafford, and we think Lombardi comes from the Saints. We kind of think, well, he must be a wide-open, high-flying offense. The Saints' success often, when he was there, and if they have success, it stems from base personnel, a fullback on the field or two tight ends, and taking well-designed downfield shots out of base personnel. But you can only play that way if you have a respectable running game and probably a backfield screen game as well, which Detroit has made a conscious effort to have over the years. Right now, for a variety of reasons, they're getting neither. And it's if they want to improve it, I think it starts with the offensive line. The problem is it's not the most gifted offensive line in the league, and it's young in some spots as well.
Yeah. On the Seahawks side, here's something that I wrote about, and I think that the Seahawks hurt me, or at least heard the fans clamoring for more Jimmy Graham after they traded a first rounder and Max Unger for him. Was it a first rounder?
Yeah, it was a late first rounder.
Yeah, late first rounder. He gets targeted 10 times in weeks 1 and 2, 0 from the slot, which I think is where he was the most effective in New Orleans. In week 3 at the Bears, a team that is really struggling on defense, he gets targeted 8 times, twice while in the slot. I think that is a function of the Bears being pretty sloppy on defense and not really having an answer for a player like Graham. So maybe we get a better idea of how they'll use Graham against the Detroit Lions, who have had some defensive struggles of their own. But if you watched this game, what was your impression of the way that they used Jimmy as opposed to how he was utilized in the loss to Green Bay?
Yeah, and I did watch this game, and editors had me write about Graham midweek, so I did watch him extra closely. And I think this game last week was a starting point. They made a deliberate effort to get the ball to Graham, and several of his catches, probably half of them, were a function of plays that were designed specifically for him, and that included the 30-yard touchdown against our guy that we mentioned earlier, Brock Vereen. Those were well-designed plays. They were just regular tight end plays, though. They could have been designed for any tight end. I think the next step with Graham is designing stuff for Jimmy Graham and putting him in the slot, putting him out wide, moving him around, and getting the full value out of his versatility. Jimmy Graham's not a normal tight end. And the more you can move him around, defenders hate facing Graham because of the factor of moving him around. Little cornerbacks don't match up well to him. Linebackers, safeties, most of them can't run with him. He's the most unique matchup of any tight end in the league, save for maybe Gronkowski. And you could argue he's even more unique because he's a better raw athlete. But that's what they need to do next with Graham, is really build him into the formations more. And it could start this week. It might take him a few weeks because I get the sense they didn't quite have a full plan for him when he came in.
As always, we like to finish the show with our recommended non-football reading of the week, just to show you that we are well-rounded human beings and not all we think about is football all day. Andy, do you have anything for the good people?
I read a book last week called Paris Trout. It was okay. It's probably on a 1 to 10. It's probably about a 6, a little above average.
This is terrible recommended reading. It's not like this book reading. It's recommended.
Well, okay, but I read it. I gave it – it was a 6. I mean, that's what I read last. I can't go – you know, here, though, I was teeing up the next thing. I got my New Yorker last week, and David Sedaris had a piece in it, finally. He's not been in there in a while, so – anything David Sedaris is highly recommended, and he was in the New Yorker this week.
Okay. I'll give you an online piece that's going to take far less time to read than a book because I know you don't have the attention span. TheIntercept.com, which is a relatively new website. Edward Snowden is an editor on the site, I believe, and it's promoting transparency in government. They write, "Why is Oklahoma so eager to kill Richard Glossop?" by Liliana Segura. Glossop today had his execution stayed by Governor Mary Fallon or halted to investigate questions about lethal injection protocols. The story that I'm talking about focuses on Michael Scott, who heard a jailhouse admission from the guy who is basically the reason Richard Glossop is being executed, that he pinned the murder on Glossop. So very interesting non-football week, very interesting football week. We thank you for joining us. As always, feel free to tweet us at hashtag MMQB podcast. We'll be throwing those tweets into the discussion. Thanks to our producers, Alex Abnos and Dan Bloom, and our editors, Mark Mravick, Matt Gagne, Gary Gramling, Kaylin Kaler. Until next week, this has been the MMQB Podcast with myself, Robert Klimko, and my friend, Annie Benoit.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys, and Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.